It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
You actually do more than just Eat the State. I fail to mention that on a regular basis because I assume people just know, but you write for the Seattle Weekly. You write for WorkingForChange.com.
WorkingForChange.com is a Working Assets website. I show up on Common Dreams and Alternet a lot. I do do radio stuff. I have a nationally syndicated short commentary that I do. So yeah, I keep busy. If you want the full list, just Google my name because a lot of stuff pops up.
All right. Well, let's start out with we do normally with local stuff and schools. Looks like more proposals for closing schools.
Yeah, they're taking a second crack at it. Last year, the Seattle School District, because of severe budget shortfalls that the current board inherited from the last board and the rather disastrous Joseph Olszewski tenure, proposed closing 10 schools, and there was this huge community uproar because of the schools that they chose to close, and so they retreated and said they were going to take another crack at it and it would be more inclusive and listen more to the community. Well, apparently they listened a lot more to the community north of the Ship Canal than anywhere else, because the new list is out. They're proposing closing 12 schools, and overall 16 schools will be affected. 11 of those 16 schools are south of the Ship Canal. Of the 9 schools that are going to be closed entirely, as opposed to having their populations moved elsewhere, 8 of them have majority non-white populations. And so there are really two huge issues that have come up almost immediately for the parents and supporters of these affected schools. One of them is race. And there's going to be a huge outcry over race about this. You know, the MLK Elementary is targeted again. There are a number of schools targeted that, as I say, have majority non-white populations. The other issue that has come up is, you know, because the Seattle School District changed its criteria for picking the schools, this time they looked primarily at academic achievement and then also the size of the schools, as opposed to last time when they tried to balance it out more by geography. Unfortunately, this does a couple of things. Number one, the academic achievement, again, points you in the direction of non-white schools where there's more students who have English as a second language, there are more students coming from troubled households, and so forth. But the fact that they're also looking at schools that have smaller populations means that it skews toward targeting schools with alternative programs. And so, for example, you have Graham Hill Elementary, which is one of only two schools in the public school district that has a Montessori program, the other one being Bagley. You have the new school being targeted. You have Summit K through 12 is going to be moved. There's just several of these. Thurgood Marshall Elementary, which has a specific program for African American boys, that's going to be affected. The list just goes on. So The one thing all of these schools with alternative programs have in common, you know, they were created to try and reach kids who don't prosper through the sort of, you know, traditional approach, which has been just exacerbated by the implementation of the WASL, which is, you know, you sit down, you cram on a subject, you take a test. And now with WASL, you take tests that are specifically geared toward making sure that you can pass the big test. And, you know, I'm sorry, but a lot of kids just don't learn well that way. There are many different ways of learning and absorbing the curricula and then being checked to make sure that the kids are retaining the curricula. And the Seattle schools in their proposal to close these schools are really, they're skewing the process so that students who learn in non-traditional ways are really being disadvantaged by this program. You also get these small schools that have very supportive, very involved parents. We're going to hear a lot more about a lot of these schools because a lot of parents are very strong advocates for these schools, and they're going to, and in fact, have already started descending upon the committee that's making these recommendations and eventually of the school board to try and reconsider some of these things. The recommendations will be finalized next week by May 30th, and then it's anticipated that the school board will make a final decision on July 26th. So basically there's 2 months to try and get this right, or the school district may have to go back and take a third crack at it.
And the school district is proposing this because they came up with that 20-some million dollar shortfall.
It was actually more than that, but yes, they are in financially a very deep hole because of some of the policies from the past administration.
So while they're trying to figure out funding for that, meanwhile, the city is looking at the Sonics, which are asking for a $220 million starter amount for a new arena.
Yes, well, that's different. We have to have our basketball, and of course, it's all for the kids. Interesting development in the whole Sonic saga this week. The Chris Van Dyke, who folks may remember from Citizens for More Important Things, which is basically Van Dyke's organization. Well, it still exists, at least on paper. That was the organization that fought the Mariners and Seahawks stadiums. And Van Dyke and the SEIU, actually SEIU is kind of bankrolling it, filed an initiative this week with the city. They hope to gather the 25,000 signatures they'll need to get on the November ballot. And what their initiative would do is require that the city make a profit on any deal that they sign with the Sonics. In fact, not only that they would make a profit, but it would be the wording here that it has to make a profit that equals the cost of a 30-year U.S. Treasury bond, which is most recently about 7%, so that basically they're saying that the city has to make a profit of about $15 million a year for them to sign any kind of a deal with the Sonics. That's a pretty high bar to set. It certainly isn't what the Sonics have in mind, because the Sonics would like to keep all of the profit from a refurbished Key Arena for themselves. So it kind of makes the deal that the only way that the city should be involved in financing a Sonics arena is if the city is generating money rather than simply costing the taxpayers money. So it'd be very interesting to see if this gets on the ballot and what the fight will be.
All right. Well, there was a lawsuit that had been filed against BP that turned out for the better this week.
Yeah, Fred Fellman, a tireless advocate for oceans and fighter of ocean pollution and so forth. His group, Ocean Advocates, had filed suit several years ago against BP. What they wanted to do basically was expand their refinery up in Anacortes in a way that Fellman claimed quite accurately would have exceeded the limits that were imposed by the 1977 Warren Magnuson Act. And now we've talked about this lawsuit on this program in the past because this was the inspiration for BP going to the House of Representatives and then to Senator Ted Stevens in the Senate and trying to get the Magnuson Act repealed and to get oil tankers into Puget Sound. It was all about corporate welfare for BP. Putting oil tankers in the Sound wasn't just theoretical. The idea was that the tankers in the Sound would go to this BP refinery. Well, this week, BP settled the lawsuit in a way that Fellman considers a victory. They're not going to expand the refinery. And above and beyond that, they're also going to do a long-term study that looks at the feasibility of setting up barges and tugs that would monitor the oil tankers and traffic coming into the Sound, not just from the northeast corner of the Olympic Peninsula where they're in the Sound proper, but all the way out to Nia Bay, all the way out to the tip of the Olympic Peninsula. And this is something that environmentalists have been fighting for many, many years, is to get the Coast Guard to consider this, and oil companies have been dead set against it. So now it looks like we're going to get some movement on that score as well. So good job, Fred.
All right. And actually, we were going to report this last week, but Boeing, they're singing the tune, Here Comes the Judge.
Yeah. Boeing, of course, has long been a revolving door for, you know, hiring people that have been involved in the appropriations business in Congress. You know, the idea being that the folks retire from Congress, they go to work for Boeing, and then they call up all their old friends and say, can you do a favor for me? It's very much the old Boeing and the Yellow Gal Network, and this was the scandal that got Boeing into trouble with the Air Force a couple of years ago. Well, now they've taken this one more step. A couple weeks ago, J. Michael Luttig, which is a name people may be familiar with or may remember from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, he was an extremely conservative jurist who was shortlisted by President Bush twice to go on the U.S. Supreme Court last year. He did not make the U.S. Supreme Court, and now he's no longer in the federal court system at all because he has been hired by Boeing as a senior vice president and their general counsel. Now, ask yourself why Boeing might need an expert in constitutional law to be their general counsel, and the obvious answer is they don't. However, hiring somebody who is very much favored by the Bush administration and has a lot of contacts within the Bush administration is something they would do very well. But think what a worrisome precedent this is when you're hiring sitting federal judges, and this for a very large company that, you know, at any given time could have any number of cases, lawsuits against it, whatever, in the federal court system. The message that it sends to sitting federal judges is that if you take actions that we like, whether it's on our case or whatever, but particularly cases involving us, we could turn around and make you a very, very rich judge. It really does corrupt the process in some worrisome ways. And the fact that, you know, we get every single press release that the Boeing press information people send out highlighted in our daily local papers, but this didn't get any attention at all. It just tells you all you need to know about our local Boeing coverage, because this should have been a major national story, and it was not.
So the revolving door just got a major upgrade there.
Yes.
Including judges now.
The revolting door, yes.
All right. Well, briefly talk about the two covered senatorial candidates here, Maria Cantwell and Mike McGavick.
Yeah, Maria Cantwell did an interesting little stunt along with Dianne Feinstein from California. She's been all over the case of trying to ensure that Enron does not rip off local utilities like Snohomish County PUD, Seattle City Light, the utility company in Tacoma, the Port of Seattle. The Snohomish County PUD is a particular issue because Enron is actually suing them for breach of contract because Enron fell apart and couldn't deliver the electricity that they had promised, but Snohomish PUD canceled the contract, and now Enron wants, I forget the exact figure, it's something like $144 million with interest to collect from Snohomish, and Snohomish is having defended itself against this. Well, Cantwell and Feinstein have filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and what they want is the investigative material that the federal prosecutors have gathered in their case against Enron and its executives. They want to be able to look at this material and use it so that local utilities can defend themselves against the lawsuit and, in fact, not only defend themselves but also turn around and sue Enron for fraudulent contract and all the rest of that. So good for Maria on that one. You know, there are some issues in which she is very good. Mike McGavick, on the other hand, her probable Republican opponent, got himself in a little hot water. Turns out for the first quarter fundraising which is considered very key in national races because how you do and fundraising for the first quarter of an election year determines to a great degree how much additional national money you'll be getting in subsequent months. This, for example, is why Darcy Berners pushed to get a lot of money in her race against Dave Reichert in the 8th Congressional District was so important. It freed up a lot of additional money and national media attention that she otherwise wouldn't have gotten. Well, it turns out McGavick padded his first quarter fundraising report that he filed with the Federal Elections Commission by 150,000 $1,000. It went from something like $700 to something like $850. So it's, you know, fairly sizable jump. And the way he did it, if you saw all of those TV ads that he was flooding the airwaves with in this state in late March and early April, he didn't pay for those up front, which is the normal practice for political campaigns. He got it on 30-day credit, and then he turned around and pushed his payment into the second quarter, thereby putting that particular debt into the second quarter and saying he had a lot more money on hand than he actually does. Because if you incur the debt, even if you haven't paid it yet, it should have still been in the first quarter report. So McGavick was just a little bit slimy on that one. He also had a statement this week, which very few people paid attention to, that essentially endorsed what President Bush has been pushing for a while, which is a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. So when Mike McGavick presents himself as a moderate Republican, don't believe it for a second.
All right. Well, here's a question for you. What do Doc Hastings and ethics have in common?
Not very much, actually, but Doc Hastings, the congressman from Eastern Washington, Republican, who's been in his cushy seat for a while now, was the person that Tom DeLay installed to be his pliant chairman of the House Ethics Committee at the beginning of last year, when DeLay was in a lot of problems, had been reprimanded three times in 2004. And so he got Hastings, who DeLay had done a lot of fundraising for, and Hastings turned around and basically abolished the House Ethics Committee. It didn't meet. It didn't do any investigation. I mean, this is in the middle of Jack Abramoff and Duke Cunningham and all these other various issues. And the Ethics Committee did absolutely nothing under Hastings. In fact, if you go to Hastings' website, it doesn't even mention his role on the House Ethics Committee at all, even though he's the chair. Well, now Tom DeLay is on his way out of Congress, and President Bush's ratings are in the 20%. You know, under 30%. And so Republicans are suddenly looking for a way to distance themselves from the White House. So lo and behold, Doc Hastings resuscitated the House Ethics Committee this week. He announced that there would be investigations of Robert Nye, who's the Ohio Republican who's expected to be indicted in the Jack Abramoff case, of William Jefferson, who's a Democrat who's facing corruption charges in Louisiana, and that he would further explore the charges surrounding Duke Cunningham. Now, the Cunningham case is probably the most important of the three, and the reason it is that there's several other investigations that are going on. In fact, at least three of them that are probing the role of other congresspeople in the Cunningham case. Now, some of these will be fairly familiar names. Catherine Harris, for example, representative from Florida. She's now running for Senate in Florida. She was Secretary of State in Florida during the 2000 election campaign, and was basically, you know, she's basically gotten congressional office as a Republican reward for all the good yeoman's duty she did in suppressing vote counts and voter turnout in Florida in 2000 and putting Bush into the White House. Well, turns out that Catherine Harris accepted some $32,000 from a defense contractor, one of the guys involved in the Cunningham case, who then turned around and asked her to put a facility in her district and, you know, earmark the money. Well, she was not able to. She was not successful in that attempt. But another congressperson, a guy from Virginia named Good, ironically enough, was successful. He took $46,000 from this same contractor and then turned around and put a $3 million plant and an overall project worth $9 million into his Virginia district. So the Cunningham case is expanding to include potentially a lot of other Republican congresspeople. Definitely keep an eye on that. Now, we also had this same week yet another Republican congressperson, a guy named Lewis. Actually, I have his first name here somewhere. Somebody on the Appropriations Committee, Jerry Lewis, in fact, not to be confused with the entertainer, Republican from San Bernardino. He's chair of the House Appropriations Committee, which is a very cushy and pivotal position. And he He had, again, he's under investigation by the Justice Department because of his relationship with a lobbyist that specializes in getting earmarks, a guy named Bill Lowry, who's a former congressman. Lowry hired two Lewis aides. One of those aides went back to work for Lewis afterwards after making $1.5 million in 2004 and then negotiating another $500,000 in a severance package from Lowry. So, you know, a lot of this stinks all the way around, and almost all of it involves Republicans, oddly enough.
All right, moving along. General Hayden was before Congress this week.
Yes, and an awful lot came out regarding the NSA spying scandal and you know, civil liberties in general this week. There's where was this quote here? Let's see. Yeah, the we got a report, of course, that the phone monitoring specifically involved journalists. ABC News reported that ABC News and the Washington Post and the New York Times had their phone calls tracked by federal investigators. That was something that came out early in the week, and oddly enough, didn't get very much attention. The FBI has acknowledged increasingly seeking reporters' phone records and leak investigations, and you know, all of this, the warrantless spying, the data mining, and the huge database collection happened on William Hayden's watch, and yet he is expected to be confirmed fairly easily by the Senate, and we're getting really not very much organized opposition by Democrats, which is, you know, disappointing beyond words, which is to say, sort of typical Democratic behavior. It really does make you wonder what it would take to get Democrats to strongly oppose an inappropriate Bush nominee, because Hayden once again fits this pattern of breaking the law and getting a promotion that the Bush administration folks seem to be so good at. And also a report in the New York Times that after 9/11, it was Vice President Dick Cheney who pushed very hard for the NSA to do this sort of illegal domestic surveillance. And Cheney was also exposed this week as having written in the margins of Joseph Wilson's New York Times op-ed and raising a lot of the questions that later turned out to be Republican talking points as they went after and attacked Wilson. It really is sort of the smoking gun in terms of proving that it was Cheney that was not only at the heart of the effort to smear Wilson and out his wife as a CIA agent, but was really a very central figure in initiating that campaign. You would think that if Fitzgerald comes out with an indictment of Rove and with any indictments having to do with the CIA leak case itself, that Cheney could be in some degree of legal trouble. And then finally, you had a report in the Washington Post this week that Mary McCarthy, who was the senior CIA employee, was fired because she allegedly leaked national security secrets to the Post. And that was one of the last things that Porter Goss did before he was actually fired. The Post is reporting that McCarthy was actually fired because she had objected internally to the CIA for its basically lying consistently in testimony to congressional staff, that it was the CIA had consistently been misleading Congress as to what sort of domestic programs it was doing. So that was a very interesting revelation.
All right, and finally on National Guantanamo, getting some press this week.
Yeah, Guantanamo prisoners were using lamps, light fixtures, and other improvised weapons. They got into something of a brawl with guards this week who were trying to stop a detainee from committing suicide. Now, this was one of four people who attempted to commit suicide on the same day. So you can't tell me that the Guantanamo prisoners, after all this, are still not being treated horribly. At the same time, you had the United Nations who had that panel on whether the U.S. was complying with international torture agreements a couple of weeks ago in Geneva. Well, that panel came out with its report this week, actually yesterday, and Said that number one, the United States should close Guantanamo Bay, and number two, it should stop the process of extraordinary rendition, that is, shipping prisoners out to other countries that are known to practice torture. Finally, also another interesting thing that came up this week, the AP lawsuit that forced the federal government to release the name of Guantanamo detainees, prisoners, that finally happened this week. The military did release the name of Guantanamo prisoners, and what was very interesting about that was who is not on the list. All of the various people that are allegedly senior al-Qaeda people, people who were very high up and as far as being targets in the war on terror, were not on that list. So indirectly, that's actually confirmation that this secret gulag that the CIA has been denying and that the White House has been denying does in fact exist. Because if they're not at any of the known prisons, but they're still clearly being held, well, I suppose they could have been shot at some point, but this list included people who are prisoners at Guantanamo at any point. And if they're not on that list, they've got to be being held somewhere. And we don't know where.
All right. Running short on time, Iraq this week.
A lot of stuff happened in Iraq this week. We are, of course, always short on time for this program. It was a bloody week. We had reports last weekend of an offensive south of Baghdad by U.S. troops that say they were targeting Zarqawi and, you know, allegedly al-Qaeda. But that's not what the Muslim Scholars Association, which is a leading Sunni group, is claiming. They're claiming that the U.S. massacred at least 25 civilians. We also had, of course, they're still waiting to form a cabinet in Iraq. The Hartford Courant came out with a report last Sunday that the army is sending mentally ill people, people on suicide watch, even people who are suffering from PTSD, directly into combat because they are so desperately short on recruits and so desperately short of personnel in Iraq. We had that particular weekend south of Baghdad did not include 30 other Iraqis who were killed on Saturday, mostly as a result of the U.S. and a couple of car bombs that went off in Baghdad. And finally, we had a UNICEF report that came out this week saying that one quarter of children in Iraq, that's about 4 million kids, are suffering from malnutrition, that 9% are suffering from acute malnutrition, that is, they're at immediate risk of starving to death, and that figure is up from 4% in 2002 before the invasion happened.
All right, and very briefly, Iran?
Yeah, Iran was reported this week to be shelling Kurdish villages in the north of Iraq. It seems to be retribution for the fact that U.S. special forces have been very active inside Iranian borders. So it's one more little escalation in the tension between the U.S. and Iran. And it's also a reminder that if the U.S. does anything to strike Iran, that all heck is going to break loose in Iraq.
All right, and events.
Yeah, an important one coming up later today between 1 and 4 o'clock, the Walk for Peace and Healing, which was, I think, discussed on this program last week. You had a guest in here. Mm-hmm. That's going to be at Green Lake. You can register at any one of three places. The idea is to get pledges and raise funds to help bring Iraqi children over here, not only for a good meal, but for medical attention, because a lot of them need medical attention that simply can't be provided by Iraq's destroyed healthcare system. So they're raising money for that. You can register at any one of three sites, at the parking lots of the community center, at the bathhouse, or at the boathouse, anywhere around Green Lake. So between 1 and 4, show up, walk around the lake. It'll be a nice day, and you can raise money for a good cause.
All right. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a volunteer publication that can be found wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, et cetera, et cetera. Or you can find it on the web, www.eatthestate.org. We also have a blog that you can keep track of. We also, because we're a volunteer organization, happily take donations, happily take volunteers. If you're interested in writing or distributing or whatever, we can always use the assistance. And if you're interested in more information or you have comments on what you hear on this program, give us a ring. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.